Same-sex marriage is now legal across the country after this morning's decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. What do Arizonans think about that?
It is a pretty monumental feeling for everyone in the country. It's a long time coming, but then also really quick.
We held out hope that the Supreme Court would look at the Constitution and see that there's nothing in it that mandates same-sex marriage.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, Lawyers for State Schools Chief Diane Douglas and the Board of Education were back in court today. Why Rocky Mountain spotted fever is making some American Indian tribes sick.
And who's selling?
We thought they would be terrified of StubHub, but what we found was that a lot of the scalpers are actually some of the heaviest users on StubHub.
Plus, Arizona's biggest mural, and we go under the Copper Dome.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein.
In a 5-4 opinion, the U.S. Supreme Court this morning legalized same-sex marriage across the country.
Wherever we go now, we're a family. That's the big thing for me, is just being able to have a normal three kids in a house and four dogs kind of life.
We're elated for today, not only for us, but for all the couples all over the nation who have been wanting this and fighting for it.
It's something you didn't dream of 5 years ago. You thought it was so far away, and now it's all changed so fast that it's phenomenal.
It's an exciting day. It's just an exciting day.
That was Mason Height, Karen Bailey, David Cheney, and Clark Rowley Cheney this morning in downtown Phoenix. We're going to get a few perspectives from Arizonans on today's ruling, starting with Catherine Alonzo, co-chair of Equality Arizona. She says it's a huge decision with far-reaching impact.
It is a pretty monumental feeling for everyone in the country. It's, you know, I think a long time coming, but then also really quick and hoped for and anticipated by many people, but also there's no way of preparing yourself for how it's going to feel when it really happens. And so a truly monumental day.
I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, the idea that to the people who are not involved in it every day, it might feel like, boy, this just sort of happened quickly. But when you're working at it step by step, it's not quick, right?
Both. I think for a lot of people working in it, it feels quick too, in the sense that the movement and the momentum in the country around this issue has been monumental. A lot of people have talked today about how when President Obama ran in 2008, his position, he was not supportive or didn't really take a position either way on marriage equality. And now, you know, him and his administration have been at the forefront of this fight. And so that's just really quick movement, and it goes to show how the country and as people are growing up and the generation sort of voting and making decisions now are progressing, that the change around this issue has just been really, really quick.
Arizona has had some ups and downs with this issue. Did you feel like Arizona in and of itself was on a track with the rest of the country? Did you feel like it would be more of a challenge here to get something done at a state level as opposed to what the High Court did today?
Well, I think that's for a lot of people that have been involved in the movement where the feeling of it being slow comes from, and that you're right that there have been ups and downs. And, you know, in 2004, Arizona was one of the first states to defeat a same-sex marriage ban, and then in later years passed a slightly different version. And then on October, you know, we were one of the first and certainly one of the most visible states to battle SB 1062 and defeated that legislation and then achieved marriage equality on October 17th last year. So it has been up and down and back and forth, but really, really steady and aggressive movement.
Well, certainly for many, in the ethereal sense, this is a positive development. Talk more about the practical positives of this.
I had seen a wonderful tweet from somebody this morning that said, I went to sleep with the right to marry and woke up gaining just a huge number of rights, federally protected rights. And I'm glad you brought that up because it comes to, well, this is such a fantastic day, and it is, there are still rights and protections that LGBT Americans don't have access to. And so somebody can get married today or this weekend and it be legally recognized and then go to work on Monday talking about their wonderful union and get fired for being gay.
Catherine Alonzo is co-chair of the Board of Equality Arizona. Thanks very much for the time.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Critics of same-sex marriage were less excited about today's ruling from the Supreme Court. Aaron Baer is vice president of communications for the Center for Arizona Policy, which described the decision as historically tragic.
We held out hope that the Supreme Court would look at the Constitution and see that there's nothing in it that mandates same-sex marriage. You know, the Constitution is absolutely silent on the question, meaning that it's a question for the states to decide, as many have. Unfortunately, however, the five justices really read into it and created words that aren't there and mandated same-sex marriage on all 50 states.
So for folks who don't believe in same-sex marriage, what is next?
You know, I think that's the big question that we're immediately faced with. You know, I think long-term, this won't be the final word on marriage. You know, 40 years ago, the Supreme Court thought they gave the final word on marriage when they issued the decision in Roe v. Wade mandating abortion on all 50 states. And to this day, it's still one of the most hotly debated political issues of our time. So I think marriage is going to be in that same vein. But, you know, what the immediate question is, what has happened to all of those people that, to the millions of people that believe in the historical view of marriage that has stood for millennia? And I think the biggest question is the government going to force people to participate and celebrate same-sex marriage or be punished if they don't? And, you know, questions like this came up in the oral arguments that really went unanswered.
And that sort of leads to the question of, do you think that Arizona or other states might be looking at other bills similar to SB 1062, which came up a couple of years ago, was vetoed by Governor Brewer? Is that something that your group or you think others might pursue?
I think big picture, there's a lot of sort of analyzing of the decision that has come down to figure out where we go from here. You know, I think the question is going to be, how is this decision going to be implemented? Is the government going to allow for people to hold to their religious beliefs, allow for organizations? So, you know, talking about not just churches and mosques and temples, but also talking about religious schools and religious organizations that serve the poor and all of those types of organizations that do such great work in our communities. Will the government allow for them to operate according to their religious beliefs in those specific types of instances? At this point, we don't know. We have to see how this decision is going to be implemented, how people react, and exactly what the government is going to try to tell people they have to do.
What specifically will you be looking for as far as implementation to sort of give you a sense of what else might be coming?
You know, I think the big question here is exactly that. Will people of faith be allowed to still be in the marketplace, or will they be forced out? And will religious organizations still be allowed to serve our communities without being penalized?
Do you think that there is a way to preserve religious freedom while also having a same-sex marriage?
I certainly hope so. You know, it's one of those things that I think one of the things that makes our nation great is the idea that we can have disagreement, but that doesn't necessarily mean disdain, that we can have differing views and have diversity of views on things and still live together as neighbors respectfully. And that's our hope through this.
Aaron Baer is vice president of communications with the Center for Arizona Policy here in Phoenix. Aaron, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
As Aaron mentioned, there are still some questions after this morning's ruling. For more on those and some of the answers, we turn to Kaipona Nea Matsumura, associate professor of law in the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at ASU.
I think that what stands out to me about the opinion is how simple its reasoning is. The court simply said that marriage is tremendously important in our society, and essentially that because of its importance and because of the fact that it confers dignity upon the people who seek to enter it, that it can't be withheld from people on the basis of sexual orientation. And so the decision avoided a lot of the kind of confusing constitutional analysis about tiers of scrutiny or whether the law at issue, the same-sex marriage restrictions, were motivated by animus, and instead cut a much straighter path to the right to marriage equality.
Critics of same-sex marriage have been saying that this is not the last word on this issue, and they've been comparing it to the Roe v. Wade decision many years ago, while abortion is still a hot topic of discussion now. Do you see it that way? Do you think that this will continue to be an issue legally that comes up?
That's an interesting question, and I think it's hard to answer because that's almost kind of a political science question rather than a legal question. So it's, of course, true that any Supreme Court decision can be revisited in subsequent years. But whether or not it does is, I guess, indicative of how creative opponents are willing to be and how persistent they're willing to be.
There are obviously lots and lots of other issues that are sort of affected by this decision. One that comes immediately to mind is the issue of same-sex adoption and things like that. How do you think those issues might be affected by what the Supreme Court did this morning?
Well, I think that this decision will have a supportive effect on the right of same-sex couples to adopt and parenting rights of same-sex couples in generally. The reason being that parentage and marriage have often gone together. So where couples are able to marry, then a lot of times children have just been presumed to be the legal children of that marital couple. You know, the fact that same-sex couples can now marry if they choose will make it a lot easier to establish parental rights.
Some critics of same-sex marriage have said that they're really curious about how this ruling will be implemented as far as how religious freedoms are affected or protected. What kinds of things will you be looking at to see how those two issues can coexist?
Well, you know, it's interesting that in the opinion itself, Justice Kennedy mentioned that people don't have to agree, that the Constitution creates room for people to disagree about topics, you know, that the discussion can continue on. But at the same time, the court has to decide whether a set of laws might violate the 14th Amendment's right to equality and protection of the fundamental right of marriage. So in a way, he sees those two things as separate. So it's pretty clear, and this emerged during oral argument, that religious officials are constitutionally protected from having to perform religious ceremonies that don't accord with their understanding of their religious belief. The question whether private individuals, you know, within the context of the market, so people who engage in business, can refuse to serve people on the basis of their opposition to same-sex marriage. I think that's really an open question.
Kaipo Nanea Matsumura is an associate professor of law in the ASU Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. Professor, thank you.
Thanks very much for your time. It was a pleasure.
It looks like Monday will be the day. Lots of Arizonans have been waking up early recently in anticipation of a decision in the case challenging the way Arizona draws its congressional district maps. Monday is the last day for Supreme Court opinions to be released this term. For a refresher on the case, we turn to Rick Hassan, a professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine.
Arizona has taken the power to draw district lines, the lines that decide, you know, where one member of Congress's border is between his or her district and another's, taken that away from the legislature and given that to an independent commission. This was challenged by the Arizona legislature. They make the claim that under the Constitution, only the state legislature has the power to set the rules for congressional elections, including the redistricting decision, pointing to language in the Constitution, which vests the power in the state legislature. The argument on the other side is that the Supreme Court for a long time has read the word legislature in the Constitution quite broadly to include things that are passed through the initiative process, as this was, and other parts of state government that are not strictly the legislature. And so the court's expected to decide on Monday the question whether the Constitution prevents having congressional districts drawn without input from the state legislature.
Presumably, if the court holds that having an independent redistricting commission is okay, things will pretty much stay as they are. If the court rules that that's not okay, does the power then go back to the legislature?
Well, presumably the power would go back to the legislature. It might be possible to craft some kind of new commission with some input from the legislature. It's not clear whether or not the legislature has to have the sole say or how it would work. You know, we'll have to wait and see the opinion when it comes out. So it's really hard to know exactly what's going to happen next until we see the reasoning and not just the result in the case.
A lot of congressional candidates are nervously, and I would imagine in some cases, watching this decision because it could affect what their district looks like.
That's right. Although it is not clear, you know, when such a ruling would take effect, there have been cases in the past involving elections where the Supreme Court gives some time for there to be a change. So, you know, we'll have to see what the court has to say about timing as well as everything else.
How many other states would be affected by this? I know Arizona is not the only state that has this kind of commission in place.
Well, there are a number of states, I think the number is 7, that have some form of commission, but the commissions are not all the same, and some of the commissions recommend to the legislature, and those might be treated differently. One place where this is being closely watched, aside from Arizona, is California. California has a redistricting commission that draws lines for both Congress and for state legislative districts. What's interesting is that in Arizona, the Republicans are very much against the redistricting commission because it's taking power away from the Republican-dominated legislature, while in California, the Republicans very much favor the commission because it took power away from the Democratic-dominated legislature. So there's an interesting set of cross-party interests across the two neighboring states.
Rick Hassan is professor of law and political science at the UC Irvine School of Law. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
Lawyers for Superintendent of Public Instruction Diane Douglas and the State Board of Education were in court this morning. A judge was hearing arguments in the board's motion to dismiss a lawsuit filed by Douglas over who controls and can hire and fire its staffers. Gary Grotto of the Arizona Capital Times was in court this morning.
They basically just rehashed what they had written in their legal briefs, which is, you know, the board's attorney said that, you know, this is really nothing more than a power struggle. She wants the court to grant her power and control that she doesn't have. And she's trying to drag the court into what is really a political dispute. The board's attorney said that, you know, if she doesn't like board policy, she can always argue on the board as a member for change. If she doesn't like the law, she can go to the legislature. If she doesn't like individual members of the board, she can go to the governor. Douglas's attorney, he said that the law is clear, that the law says that she shall direct all employees of the board, and you know, that the board delegates their policy to her, that she has to enact, you know, the board's policy. They say it's very simple as that. It was a rather quick hearing. The judge didn't ask too many questions, but she did ask Douglas's attorney what she should put in an order if she, you know, rules in their favor.
Did the judge give any kind of sense of what might come next?
No. Like I said, she didn't ask very many questions, and you know, at the end, she said, you know, all my questions are answered, and she did say she's going to rule rather quickly. Not next week because she'll be gone, but as soon as possible. And she said that if she rules in Douglas's favor and refuses to dismiss the case, then she's going to immediately set, you know, a pretrial conference where they will decide how to proceed.
Gary Grotto is a reporter for the Arizona Capital Times. He covered this morning's hearing in court over the case between Diane Douglas and the State Board of Education. Gary, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
Still to come, Arizona's looking for more teachers, and one reason is money.
When your class size is growing every year, and when you don't have the resources you need in the classroom to affect growth, and you see that in another state, all of those negatives become positives, you're going to move.
That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for tonight, partly cloudy, won't be cooling off a whole lot. We're looking for lows around 90 degrees. And then for this weekend, the monsoon might arrive in the form of blowing dust and light rain. We should have a high of 110 tomorrow and then 109 on Sunday. Currently it's 103 degrees. In Valley traffic, accidents to watch out for on the 51 southbound at the 101. Also I-10 eastbound at 7th Street. The 202 eastbound at 48th Street, and the 60 eastbound, a collision just moved to the side of the road at Superstition Springs Boulevard. It's 2:23.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, presenting the new 2015 Subaru Legacy, the 36 MPG midsize sedan redefined. Ready now for test drives. Shop Subaru.com.
Tuition rates at Arizona's colleges and universities have grown more than any other state's since 2008. Which gave one national company the idea of offering tuition insurance. Arizona is the first of six states and the only one in the West where the insurance will be offered. Angela Gonzalez wrote about it in the Phoenix Business Journal.
Basically, they are launching this national college tuition insurance that is debuting first in Arizona. And why are we the lucky ones? Because since 2008, tuition has increased 84%.
And are they focused just on state universities? Or I was even thinking of the fact we have a lot of for-profit colleges here as well, and there's been controversy in the news about those.
Absolutely. All colleges and universities, community colleges as well, just not K-12 yet. They want to do private insurance for the private schools, the K-12, but that's down the road, 2016, they're thinking.
And what are some details about plans and who's eligible for them, et cetera?
Basically, you pay for this per semester. So as long as you buy it before you enroll in school, they have three different plans that they're offering. One is the basic plan that you just pay $29.95 for the semester. And that will, if you withdraw from school because of an illness or injury or the student dies or there's some kind of psychological or mental disorder and you completely withdraw from school, you'll get $2,500 back. And then it goes up from there. So if you want a full 100% refund, you would pay 6% of whatever your tuition, room, and board is. There's a middle one where you would pay 1.35% of your total cost of tuition, room, and board.
With college, of course, if there's a loan, then you still hold on to it after you're out of school. This is just sort of while you're in school, you're paying it semester by semester, and then once you're done with school, you're done with needing the coverage. That's kind of the basic question, yeah.
Oh, yes. If you finish school, you graduate, and you still have your loans, this doesn't count because it only counts if you withdraw, if you completely just drop out of school.
Does this only apply to folks who are going to, you know, ASU, U of A, Grand Canyon, whatever it may be, or if you're an Arizonan, does it apply anywhere you go?
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. If you're an Arizona resident, it doesn't matter what school you go to, whether you're in-state or out-of-state. All you have to do is be an Arizona resident.
So it doesn't matter if it's a state that Allianz is doing any other work with yet, as long as you're in Arizona and it works for you.
Exactly.
Angela Gonzalez is a senior reporter for the Phoenix Business Journal. Angela, thank you as always.
Thank you, Steve.
Recent headlines have suggested teachers are fleeing Arizona in record numbers. Numbers from the State Department of Education show 62% of the districts who responded to a survey during the 2013-14 school year said they had openings for teachers. There was also an increase in the number of long-term substitutes working in teaching positions. To find out how big of an issue this is, we turn to Joe Thomas. He's a teacher in Mesa Public Schools and vice president of the Arizona Education Association.
You are always going to have some retirements at the end of the school year. You're going to have some people that are in their 20s or 30s and decide that teaching is really not for them. But we're seeing a marked increase in the number of people that are either going to another state or going to another profession.
Which do you think you're seeing more of, that folks are leaving to take jobs in other states or folks are finding another line of work?
From the people that have talked to me, they want to stay in education or they want to stay close to education. But I do see probably more people that are either going back to their home state or are seeing that California pays more or that Utah pays more or that Wyoming pays more. They don't want to get out of education. And you rarely ever hear a teacher say, I don't want to teach because of the kids. It's, I can't afford to teach in Arizona anymore, or Arizona doesn't value teaching. And we live in a fairly mobile society, and with the internet, you can get your resume to another state, another district, and the districts in other states are recruiting because they know the crisis that we're having. And so they're taking some of our brightest and best and youngest teachers that are willing to move to another state and see a $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 raise.
Is it just about money? I mean, is the number one reason that you think teachers are leaving because they're not getting paid enough?
That's a big reason. Last year, I worked with teachers that had taught 8 or 9 years and received one significant raise maybe over the course of that time. And they saw other teachers being hired into the district and getting paid more. Everybody has bills, so salary is going to be part of it. But it's also about having a full supply cabinet. It's about having a reasonable class size to where you can spend one-on-one time with those kids that you know that they need so that they can achieve and they can grow the way they should. And when you are paid poorly, and when you don't see raises coming in 4 or 5 or 6 years, and when your class size is growing every year, and when you don't have the resources you need in the classroom to affect growth, and you see that in another state, all of those negatives become positives, you're going to move.
So I was going to ask you, what do we do about it? But it sounds like the answer is put more resources into public education.
Smart strategic spending. Arizona is in the bottom three every year in what we invest in education. We're $3,000 per student behind the national average. So we're not just in last place. You almost can't see us in the rearview mirror. And it gets back to the rhetoric around we want great public schools, we want quality educators, we want the best for our students. But if we're unwilling to invest, we'll never keep those quality educators. Those will be the first ones to leave to a new profession or a new district or a new school in another state.
Do you think the plan that Governor Ducey introduced a few weeks ago dealing with state trust land money, will that help stem the tide at all, do you think?
The governor's proposal is very interesting in that it looks to pull more money out of the state trust lands. This is a 100-plus-year investment. You have to be careful in how you manage that money because a trust is, it's not like a savings account. You don't just dip into it whenever you need to. A trust is supposed to be around indefinitely, and you live or you invest money into education based off the earnings of the trust. And he's looking to quadruple the payout of that. And so it would bring new money, but the opportunity cost is it's less money for future students. So it'll be interesting to see how that matures as the governor continues to talk about it. We certainly need education to be funded better, but even his plan doesn't conceivably do anything until 2017. What are we going to do for the next 2 years? Where do we find money for classrooms now to stem this exodus of teachers to other states?
Do you have any measure of optimism that this trend will subside somewhat, that Arizona will be able to retain more of its teachers?
There's going to have to be a lot of changes made in Phoenix. The one thing I do have faith in is we will always have people that want to teach. The problem is we have so many vacancies right now just because of the stresses associated with the job.
Joe Thomas is vice president of the Arizona Education Association. He's also a teacher in the Mesa Public Schools. Joe, thank you.
Thank you.
Tonight, a new exhibit opens in Glendale. It's called Stronger Than Steel and features photos of officers from the Glendale Police and Fire Departments, as well as the U.S. Border Patrol, U.S. Marshals, and some smaller agencies from southern Arizona. Photographer Ronnie Zimba has been taking photos of law enforcement and fire departments for a few years.
Most of the time when you see law enforcement photographs, it's either far from the outside, so it's an onlooker seeing it from a street, that kind of thing, so it's kind of far away. Or if it's internal, it's usually a snapshot on a cell phone camera. So it's very unusual to see what I call beyond the yellow caution tape and see it firsthand and very close up, but also in an artistic way.
So, like, how does it work? I mean, do you have, like, a police scanner and you listen for things to happen and you go and photograph it? Do you get invited out on certain calls with departments? How does it all work?
Well, it took me a long time to build the rapport with each of these departments. One of the things that's really important to me is that my mandate in doing this is to never, ever change content of the photograph. So I definitely tweak the image in terms of treatment, color, saturation, but I never change content. And so they know, each of the departments knows, that they're only going to be shown in the most positive light, which is very powerful for them to be secure in, and that nothing's going to be changed on them or manipulated on them. It's true.
It's interesting that you talk about portraying the agencies and the officers who work in them in the most positive light. This is obviously a time when, especially law enforcement agencies, have been under a little bit of pressure and a little bit of stress based on some of the actions that they've taken, in some instances here in Arizona, but mostly across the country. How much of that do you think about when you're trying to portray what you're portraying? Because as you said, accuracy is also important to you.
I think about it all the time. I think it's really important. I am very pro-law enforcement. Of course, in every department, every agency, there are those who would not necessarily hold up to the highest standards of a department. But for the most part, I have a belief, and especially now after spending so much time over the last 4 years deep in the trenches and embedded with these departments, I see how really true these men and women are to what they believe in protecting their communities, protecting us as individuals. And I see them trying to do the best they can. I also see them being much more fair than I ever imagined that they would be.
This exhibit is in Glendale. The city obviously hosted a pretty big event not that long ago with the Super Bowl. We'll be hosting some others. Were you able to follow around any of the crews as they were sort of doing their thing in anticipation of that game?
Yes, absolutely. Before, during, and after the game. So one of the most exciting things about this contract with Glendale was being able to follow the crews preparing for Super Bowl and then protecting Super Bowl. So to watch everything go into place in the morning and have all the operators get into place, to watch the SWAT operators get into position, to watch the undercover guys getting ready to go out and mix with the crowds. I mean, there was just a lot of very exciting moments to watch what it takes to man and protect and plan for such an event like this. It's watched worldwide.
Photographer Ronnie Jemba's exhibit, Stronger Than Steel, will be up for a few weeks at Gallery Glendale in Westgate. It's funded through a Glendale Public Arts grant.
Next month, Flagstaff artists plan to begin work on the second half of what is soon to be Arizona's largest mural. The 4,500-square-foot mural has been in the works for 2 years. From Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
Muralist and oil painter Sky Black was born in Flagstaff, and for several years he's wanted to paint what he called the ugliest wall in town, the east side of the historic Orpheum Theater. The building owner and city were all for it. Black just needed money and help. He found two artists who call themselves the Mural Mice, R.E. Wall and Maggie Dewar, and they got to work.
What we're calling this is actually large-scale fine art. So it's all painted by hand, by brush and palette. There's no spray paint at all. Some people are calling it the Sistine Chapel of Flagstaff.
It's actually called Sound of Flight. An enormous flock of birds appears to be flying out of an ornate piano. In the last 2 years, dozens of local businesses and hundreds of people have donated more than $30,000 to the project. The artists hope to receive an $8,000 grant to finish it. Black says public art has a way of bringing the community together.
In a way, like everyone who's helped and who lives in Flagstaff has an ownership of the wall, of the actual mural itself. So I tell everyone, this mural belongs to you, so please take care of it.
The artists have dealt with strong winds, rainstorms, and three-story tall scaffolding. Black says he and his team are unstoppable, and in the next few months, they plan to celebrate the mural's completion. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
Coming up, Native American tribes are seeing many more cases of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, but why?
Really, this perfect storm of free-roaming and untreated dog populations. Native Americans aren't at any increased risk biologically.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Checking Valley traffic, accidents, I-17 southbound at Camelback. That has the center lane blocked. I-10 westbound at 7th Avenue. I-10 eastbound at 7th Street. And on the 202 eastbound Red Mountain Freeway, an accident at 48th Street. Partly sunny skies in the Valley forecast for the next couple of days. Look for a high today of 110. Partly cloudy tonight. Overnight lows of only 90. Partly sunny tomorrow with a high of 110, 109 on Sunday with a slight chance for some rain. Right now in Phoenix with relative humidity of 21%, sunny and 103 degrees at 238.
KJZZ is supported by APS. ABS is putting the sun to work for customers. Their solar partner program is bringing more rooftop solar to Arizona and helping APS plan for a reliable energy future. APS.com/next.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jim Hawk. An official with knowledge of the hunt for two New York prison escapees says one of the men has been shot and killed. Richard Matt was killed, but David Sweat is still on the run. The two broke out of the maximum security prison in northern New York State on June 6. The Supreme Court has declared that same-sex couples have a right to marry anywhere in the United States. The landmark 5-4 ruling means 14 states will have to stop enforcing their bans on same-sex marriage. The ruling is sparking an emotional response around the country. NPR's Kirk Sigler is in Los Angeles.
Standing aside, his husband of 7 years, Jose Ortiz Barrado, tears up as he says that he was raised in a conservative Catholic family of Mexican Americans here. He says his family and his community have already come a long way on the issue of gay marriage.
But you know what? I think things are changing. You know, even the Pope has said, who is he to go ahead and judge?
Ortiz Barrado and his husband married in 2008 before Proposition 8 overturned gay marriage in California. Their legal status was since restored, but they say they're celebrating today because now their union is recognized across all 50 states. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Emotions are running high on both sides. Those opposed to gay marriage are expressing their unhappiness with today's Supreme Court ruling, many calling it judicial overreach in a manner that should be left to the states. Pastor Rick Scarborough is president of Vision America in Texas.
Extreme grief, that only way I can sum it up. I groaned in my spirit.
And Scarborough says this is not the end of the fight against legalized same-sex marriage. President Obama gave the eulogy today at the funeral for Reverend Clemente Pinckney, who was killed last week in the basement of the AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, along with 8 parishioners. Obama ended by joining the choir in the crowd and singing Amazing Grace. 6 more funerals are pending. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
While many cities around the country, like Washington, D.C., are making great strides in the development of solar energy, Arizona and Phoenix in particular were leading markets that are now falling behind in the industry. Part of the reason for the change may be the increasing costs for residential producers of solar power, but policies adopted by the utilities and the state are the main driving force in this developing field. To talk more about the impact of solar energy policy, we're joined by Dan Shawan, a visiting fellow at the independent research group Resources for the Future. Dan, how rapidly is the industry changing, and is Arizona risk falling behind if these kind of trends continue?
Well, the industry is changing rapidly, and that's partly because of improvements in the technology that have reduced costs, and partly because the expertise for installing solar is continuing to improve and expand. Arizona does run a risk of falling behind, of course, if its policies stop supporting solar installations.
Are there examples of states that, at least in the opinion of what you've seen, are doing it right at this point?
Not everyone agrees on what doing it right is, so
okay.
Reasonable people can disagree about that. But there are some principles that one should keep in mind. One is that there are advantages of solar over the forms of generation that we've been relying on for decades, especially coal and also natural gas. Much less emissions from solar, you know, some emissions from making the solar panels, and then, of course, none from using them. That's a significant advantage. The estimated deaths per year from the emissions of fuel-burning power plants in the U.S. are about 10,000. And you also, of course, have the greenhouse gas emissions from the other power plants. Another principle to keep in mind, though, is that when a customer generates power is important. During some hours, it's really expensive for the utility to get power, additional power, and so it's appropriate for the price of electricity to be high then. During other hours, the utility can get power cheaply, and it's appropriate for the price to be low then. So getting the prices to reflect the actual costs of obtaining power is another appropriate thing to do, and that's something that Salt River Project has done in its rate change.
Dan, what about folks who say that developments in solar, for example, and changes should be market-driven. I mean, that can mean some things to some people and maybe something else to others. Do you think that's a productive way of looking at it?
Well, certainly it's good to rely on markets to the extent that one can to promote efficient decisions. However, there are some other factors at work here, and one of them is the advantages that solar provides over other generation. That's worth something, and so it's appropriate for folks who install solar to get a break on their bills that matches the environmental advantages that they're providing to everyone.
Do you think generally innovations in solar are going to be a major part and a vital part of U.S. energy policy as we go forward?
There's the potential for that, and that would be a very good thing, I would say. You know, any technology that doesn't produce much pollution and that becomes the cheapest way of generating power, or almost the cheapest way of generating power, would be a very good thing for society. And solar is looking very promising, both because of the cost reductions that we've seen so far in solar, especially in the last few years, and also because of the work of scientists and engineers who have identified some promising ways to potentially further reduce the cost of solar tremendously.
Dan Schotten is a visiting fellow at the independent research group Resources for the Future.
The business of rooftop solar has been a hotly debated one in Arizona recently, as utilities have tried to adjust net metering programs. That refers to plans under which solar customers get credits from utilities for the power they send back to the grid. This week, the group Environment Arizona released a report which shows solar customers provide more benefit than they get. Brett Fanshaw is the group's solar program coordinator.
It comes at a time when utilities like Arizona Public Service are urging the Arizona Corporation Commission to increase fees on solar customers. And, you know, the report shows that while some utilities claim they're subsidizing solar panel owners, the report shows that the opposite is actually probably true. And if anything, utilities should be paying people who go solar more and not less.
What does the report find as far as one of the utility's main arguments, which is that folks who don't have solar are paying a disproportionate share of maintenance to the grid?
Sure. So the report takes a broader view of the issue of clean energy and particularly distributed solar energy, and points out that the value of distributed solar is quite high when you look at the fact that you won't have increased costs for new power plants or transmission lines. You'll have a more stable grid. And you'll have reduced costs for environmental compliance and things like that as we implement more distributed solar on rooftops across Arizona and across the country. And so the value for having that distributed resource is quite high. And the utilities credit people back for the excess energy they produce through net metering, typically at the retail rate of electricity. The report shows that the value of solar is actually quite above that retail rate of electricity. And so the net metering is actually a pretty good deal for utilities as far as crediting people back for the amount of energy that they're producing.
Those benefits, though, seem like more like long-term benefits, not immediate. They would require many, many more people to have solar panels on their home or on their business. So how do we find a common middle ground here so that everybody can be happy until those goals can actually be realized?
Sure. And I think that's exactly where we want to go. We want to encourage people to go solar and to create a future where the vast majority of our energy is coming from clean resources, and that's certainly what Environment Arizona stands for. And I think programs like net metering, where people are getting fair compensation for the amount of energy that they're producing and sending back to the grid, is a good baseline, and I think we should keep using those policies. And our report points out that we should not be doing things like trying to gouge solar customers for increased fees on top of that.
Brett Fanshaw is Solar Program Coordinator for Environment Arizona, based here in Phoenix. Brett, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
We're Rocky Mountain spotted fever has been around since the 19th century, but hadn't been associated with Arizona until very recently. A new study teamed the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention with the Indian Health Service on how Rocky Mountain spotted fever has become an epidemic among the state's tribes. Dr. Naomi Drexler is a CDC epidemiologist and one of the study's authors. She explains why the study came about.
So we discovered Rocky Mountain spotted fever originating in Arizona in 2003. We hadn't seen many cases occurring in that area previously because the more common tick vectors in the United States aren't really present in Arizona. So in 2003, after one case was discovered and treated by the Indian Health Service, we did a follow-up investigation and found that a different tick vector was causing Rocky Mountain spotted fever in Arizona.
Can you go into more specifics on that?
Since 2003, we've had more than 300 cases of Rocky Mountain spotted fever in Arizona and about 15 deaths. A lot of those have been amongst children, which have come out as a high-risk category for severe illness and death.
What are the best ways at this point to prevent it?
Preventing Rocky Mountain spotted fever is really about preventing tick bites. There's no vaccine that's available, and so really it's about reducing your potential risk to tick bites and tick exposures. What we recommend is checking yourself for ticks daily, treating your pets for ticks routinely, wearing insect repellent when outdoors, treating your homes and yards, and then making sure that if you develop symptoms after being in a tick-infested area or being around ticks, that you go to the doctor immediately.
What have the costs been to treat it?
The disease cost from Rocky Mountain spotted fever in Arizona has been estimated to be around $13.2 million. And that includes costs associated with the acute illness and treatment, as well as long-term productivity or loss of time due to illness and death. So $13.2 million in costs, and that's compared to what we would estimate for community-wide intervention programs to be about $3 or $4 million in that same time period and for those same populations.
There are certainly illnesses and diseases that are associated with certain ethnic groups and certain backgrounds. Is there something about Rocky Mountain spotted fever that would make Native Americans more susceptible to its effects?
Rocky Mountain spotted fever can really affect anyone. The reason why we've seen Rocky Mountain spotted fever localized to American Indian reservations in Arizona is really this perfect storm of free-roaming and untreated dog populations. Native Americans aren't at any increased risk biologically. It's just the environment that they're in and the free-roaming dogs that are common within their communities.
Are there any obstacles to overcome there in order to get tribal communities to say, great, thank you for the information, we will take this and run with it?
We've had really wonderful interactions with all of the Arizona tribes thus far, working with Indian Health Service, the Arizona Department of Health Services, as well as Maricopa County and a lot of your local county health departments. Everybody has really been engaged in this issue since the very beginning. And what we've done is we've taken all of our lessons learned in various communities and shared them throughout with all of those partners and entities so that everybody knows what the newest research is, how they can best build their prevention programs. And the tribes have really taken up this information and run with it in a very positive way.
Naomi Drexler is an epidemiologist for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Naomi, thank you for the time.
Thank you so much.
You've probably driven past the Capitol and barely noticed, yet she's been there for more than a century. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us the story behind Arizona's most famous weather vane.
The Wind Victory statue has been on top of the Arizona Capitol Copper Dome since 1901. She was purchased specifically to adorn the territorial government building. Did you know Wind Victory was once a shooting target for cowboys?
In the territorial days when the cowboys used to go down on Washington Street was the Barbary Coast of Arizona in those days, and all the saloons and things, the cowboys would come into town and they'd be drinking it up. Then they'd ride out to the Capitol, way out of town to the Capitol, and then they'd shoot at her wings to make her spin.
That's Marshall Trimble, the Arizona State historian.
And people, over the years then, the story was told, people thought, oh, that was just a tall tale spun.
Well, it wasn't. In the 1950s, when the dome was first being refurbished, it was discovered that there were bullet marks on the statue's wings. Winged Victory is actually older than the state of Arizona. It was purchased in 1898 for $150. At the time, the Arizona Territorial Capitol was under construction. When it was completed a couple of years later, it was installed on the dome. She is actually a 17-foot-tall, 600-pound wind vane. She sits on a rotating pedestal and spins when the wind hits her wings. Historians believe that's why the cowboys shot at her.
So the stories were true, spinning her around. And a cowboy artist named Russell Houston has a great rendering of that.
Grandpa Percy, my wife's maternal grandfather, talked about it. I believed it. You know, it sounded like something that somebody who was a little inebriated might do.
Russ Houston put a lot of time into researching the story. His canvas depicts five cowboys in front of a large gray-colored Arizona State Capitol with Wind Victory on the dome. Most of the men are mounted on their horses with pistols in hand, raised over their heads, aimed toward the Capitol.
I'm not sure if that's exactly how it happened, but in my mind, I thought that would be the best depiction, is to show them just kind of gathered in front, popping away.
This is not the only time Wind Victory was under attack. State historian Trimble says in the 1950s, lawmakers were tired of looking at her back, so they had her tethered in place so she couldn't move. But by the 1970s, she was back to her old spinning self. If you want to see Houston's painting, it's on display at the Bashes Art Gallery in Chandler. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or know things that you'd like to tell us about, please send us an email, theshow@kjzz.org.
And good afternoon. This is The Show on KJZZ, an original production mixing news and features from the Valley, the region, along with national and international news. In very local news, in Valley traffic, an accident I-10 westbound at 7th Avenue, another in the median I-10 eastbound at 51st Avenue. And if you're on the 51 southbound, couple of accidents to watch out for, one at the 101 and the other at Shea. Promises to be a very hot, maybe a little bit muggy weekend as well. Look for high temperatures of 110 and 109. Currently with relative humidity up to 21%, it's 103 degrees at KJZZ at 255.
KJZZ is supported by Valley Metro, working to benefit the community, including those who rarely use public transit, by creating sustainable jobs through further development of the transportation system. ValleyMetro.org/connected.
When you think psychic, you're no doubt imagining someone who will try to predict your future or make a connection with your mind to explain what's going on in your life. But this Sunday's Phoenix Psychic Fair is emphasizing things that are at least a bit more practical. Dr. Emil Faith is a medical medium and in charge of the event. Dr. Faith, this is the sixth annual event, so what's changing from year to year?
The biggest thing, Steve, is the fact that we are the new owners. We've had this for about a year. My wife and I, Susan and I, who are both practitioners and actually metaphysicians and holistic practitioners ourselves, are bringing our own new energy, our new ideas, and fresh thoughts in terms of layout of the room, in terms of our selection of readers, healers, and vendors, and then just instilling a sort of whole new culture and new feeling for the whole group as a room. So it makes a big difference. It's always about energy, and we're here to bring new energy and have been bringing new energy to this event.
I think a lot of people, when they hear psychic fair, they're thinking in terms of, you know, people who are going to predict things for them, that know sort of what's to come in their lives. Were there thoughts about changing the name of the event to reflect that?
We're not so much into, and we don't believe in predictions. A lot of people think of the fortune teller and the snake oil salesman. We're moving far, far away from that. This is about professional people, who are in practice, who are not here just to predict what boyfriend they're going to meet, or what their husband's going to do, or when they're going to make their first million. This is more about working through the individual's current life issues, helping them see what their blocks are, the challenges, and giving them options about how to move forward and better their life. This isn't about when is this going to happen and when will I meet Joe and when will I meet Sarah. This is about, let me tell you what's going on in your life and why your life is the way it is, And let me give you some suggestions on how to improve it.
What does it mean to be a medical medium?
You know, I was blessed with a gift to be able to sit with somebody, get a sense of their energy field, look into their body, and get a sense of which organ systems are not functioning correctly. So I tune in. I take a look at each of the organ systems, and I get a sense of where the energy blocks are, what's out of balance, and what needs to be done to get things back flowing correctly. It's always about energy.
How do they know that what you're saying is legitimate?
Well, that's the beauty of a fair like this, an event like this, where you get to spend just a little bit of time with me and other people like me and get a sample and see how accurate I am, see if I am picking up on what they know to be true. And fortunately, I've been blessed to be able to be pretty darn accurate, and you get a chance to sign me out.
Dr. Emil Faith on Sunday's Phoenix Psychic Fair.
If you want to go to a ball game, you've got a few options for where you can get your tickets. You can buy them at the box office or online or from a third-party seller, or you can go to the ballpark and buy them from the people outside the stadium. And new research from ASU finds that might be where you get the best deal. Gable Taggart is a doctoral student in the ASU School of Public Affairs and a senior research fellow in the university's Center for Organizational Research and Design. He led data collection and co-authored a paper on ticket scalpers.
We did have some general questions we were interested in. We'd noticed that they were competing and cooperating at the same time. That was interesting to us. We noticed that they seemed to have groups or teams of scalpers. And from our perspective, we study organizations. That's pretty interesting.
So what did you find as far as how these different groups of ticket scalpers work together and in some cases maybe don't work together?
Right. So if you have two groups of ticket scalpers and they have the same tickets they're trying to sell you, they're really territorial and they're really aggressive about trying to get people to come buy from them instead of the other group. But if you ask a ticket scalper for a ticket and he doesn't have that ticket, but he knows the other group does, he'll actually take you over to them. I had a ticket scalper walk me two blocks because I asked for a specific ticket.
Wow.
And he knew he had a buddy. He walked me two blocks to the spot where, the other ticket scalper had that ticket that I was looking for. So sort of interesting that they compete so harshly, but they also cooperate.
How do they know what the other people have?
Well, as far as we know, the majority of the ticket scalpers at Chase Field have been in place since 2001. And these teams have their territories, and they formed pretty quickly after the Diamondbacks were started. And so I think there's 81 home games each year. They've been working for 15 years. They start to get to know each other.
How do secondary markets like StubHub play into what they're trying to do?
So this was probably one of the most fascinating things about our research is we thought they would be terrified of StubHub. But what we found was that a lot of the scalpers are actually some of the heaviest users on StubHub because they have such a handle on what the market is. You know, for a specific team coming on at a specific time, they really know where the prices should be. And so they're the most equipped to take advantage of a good deal on StubHub. So they'll buy and they'll flip really quickly. And then, you know, if they have a bunch of tickets they haven't sold, they'll actually bring those and sell those on the street.
The D-backs tend not to sell out their games. I mean, Chase Field is pretty big. They don't often sell out. So what's the incentive to buy a ticket from a ticket scalper when you can just go to the box office and buy a seat? In most places, you probably want to sit.
Right. So every time we would buy a ticket from the scalpers, about half the time we were there, we would just research and then leave, and then half the time we would actually buy a ticket and go to the game. And then we would check on StubHub to see what the price was, you know, kind of compare what we were getting, and then also look at the face value of the ticket to see. And pretty consistently, we were getting slightly below what the StubHub was and even below what the face value was. So actually, in our experience, the best deal was from the scalpers on the street.
So you can save some money by buying not from the team and maybe not even from StubHub.
Maybe in a one-off situation, you might not. But, you know, we did a lot of games, and pretty consistently, there were times when it was harder. If it was a hot ticket, you know, the Dodgers are in town, the Cubs are in town, you're not going to get in for below a certain price. But generally, you get a better price from the street.
Gable Taggart is a doctoral student in the ASU School of Public Affairs. He's also a senior research fellow in the Center for Organizational Research and Design at ASU. He worked on the study dealing with ticket scalpers at Chase Field. Gable, thank you.
Thank you.
There's a lot of stuff going on this weekend if you have time to enjoy it. You know, Mark, I'm considering finding out if Jeremiah really was a bullfrog because Three Dog Night is playing tonight at 8 at
Joy
Wild Horse
to
Pass.
The world. Yes. There's also a ping pong tournament tomorrow afternoon. That's at Changing Hands Bookstore in Phoenix. Are you a good ping pong player?
I was going to ask you the same thing. I'm good with my backhand.
Okay.
Unlike in tennis, where I'm bad with my backhand. So I need to put those together
at
some point.
You should.
How about tomorrow night at 7 at Tempe Marketplace, the Narcoleptic Spiders are performing.
That's scary. You can also check out Bye Bye Birdie, the musical, tonight and tomorrow at the Queen Creek Performing Arts Center.
And, of course, Sugar Ray is at 9:15 tomorrow night at the Rhythm Room in Phoenix, presenting some blues music there. The show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs are our digital team. The news director is Al Macias, and our executive producer is the ironclad one, John Hoban.
Not even sure what that means in this context. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. We're at the show at kjzz.org. And be sure to download the free KJZZ mobile app. You can podcast the show. You can hear the whole darn thing.
That's free?
That's free.
You got to get it.
No money whatsoever. You can hear the whole thing anytime you want it. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening.